Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week are Peter Rayner, Angie Hahn, and Wade Major. They'll review Dream Horse, starring Toni Collette, in a comedic drama being compared to feel-good movies like The Full Monty and Billy Elliot. The Australian crime drama The Dry stars Eric Bana. It's based on a popular novel by Jane Harper. And The New Deal for Artists is a documentary originally released 40 years ago, now newly remastered. Orson Welles narrates the film, which highlights the many artists funded during the New Deal. We'll also remember comedic actor Charles Grodin, who co-starred in Heaven Can Wait. You're listening to Dave Grusin's theme from that film. We also remember comic writer and actor Paul Mooney and actor, producer, director Norman Lloyd on Film Week.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at NortonSimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I'm joined this week by critics Angie Hahn, who's deputy entertainment editor at Mashable, Wade Major of Cinegods.com, and Peter Rayner, film critic for the Christian Science Monitor. First up this week is the comedic drama Dream Horse, starring Toni Collette, Damian Lewis, and Owen Teal. Eros Lin is the director, and Neil McKay wrote the screenplay of Dream Horse. Angie, please start us off.
So this is a dramedy about a bunch of neighbors from small town Wales who band together to breed a racehorse, and it's based on a true story. Toni Collette plays Jan, a grocery store cashier and bartender who leads the group and does most of the caretaking, and Damian Lewis plays Howard, who's an accountant and the only member of the group that's actually been a part of a racehorse syndicate before. And it's the kind of movie where you have a pretty good idea going in of what you're going to get from it, and it delivers exactly that. It's super cheesy, super formulaic, but it is also a total crowd pleaser. If you like that kind of film, if you're in the mood for something kind of inspirational and uplifting and a little bit silly, I think it really fits the bill. You've got your little town, your wacky neighbors, and like this ragtag group of somewhat misfits rankling the blue bloods of the usual thoroughbred horse racing scene. It's got really touching scenes of Toni Collette's character in particular. She does great work here as a woman who has realized that her entire life has passed her by, and she's now channeling a lot of that energy into this horse. And the racing scenes actually have a lot of tension. There's nothing wrong with getting exactly what you want if it's also, there's nothing wrong with getting exactly what you expected if it's also exactly what you wanted.
We're talking about Dream Horse starring Toni Collette. Wade, what'd you think?
I thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, it's what Angie said. We know what we're getting. It's that predictable dish that we've eaten so many times before, but we love it. It's that particular kind of underdog sports film mixed with that blue-collar underdog British thing that we've seen so many times, Brassed Off, The Full Monty, Billy Elliot, Fisherman's Friends and Calendar Girls. You know, they all kind of live in that same place. It's sort of our modern-day British version of the old Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney movies. You know, everybody's got a lot of gumption and moxie, and they get together and they make a go of it. And it's that you can repackage that any number of different ways, and it's just always a pleasure to watch.
Dream Horse, Peter.
Well, I'm going to be a little curmudgeonly here. You know, it's so predictable, and I don't know that there's any. I didn't find any great pleasure in seeing a story played out that I knew exactly how it was going to play out. Toni Collette is wonderful in it. She's always wonderful, and I think is the best and perhaps only reason to see the movie. But all of the eccentric people in the village, South Wales, are just. I mean, they're pegged for who they are right from the get-go, and that's who they remain. You know, there's the town drunk, and there's this and that. You know, everybody is who they are throughout. And I didn't think the racing scenes were particularly well shot. You know, maybe it's just I've been watching, you know, the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness, but it just seemed as if they were sort of perfunctory the way it was filmed. And I could have lived without the big, you know, rousing ending where all the people get together from the cast, and I think some of the real people, and sing Delilah in a bar. There was a documentary of a very similar story a number of years back that I think was, you know, more interesting and incisive. This just seems to really, you know, it delivers exactly what you want, but I'm not sure I wanted it.
We're talking about Dream Horse, the comedic drama starring Toni Collette, Eris Lynn, the director, and Neil McKay, the screenwriter. It's rated PG. It's in wide release in movie theaters in Southern California, but you can also see it at home on demand, Google Play, and iTunes. It'll be available middle of next month. The Australian crime drama The Dry stars Eric Bana and Genevieve O'Reilly. Robert Connolly's the director and co-writer of the screenplay. Wade, please tell us about The Dry.
The Dry is one of the best Australian films I've seen in a long time. A terrific thriller slash mystery whodunit. It's based on a novel by Jane Harper. This was her debut novel just a few years ago, and it was a huge, huge seller in Australia. The movie released a few months ago in Australia to enormous numbers. Eric Bana plays a federal agent, the equivalent of an Australian FBI agent, who has to go back to his hometown to look into a murder allegedly committed by one of his childhood friends and mates. And things don't quite align, that this murder-suicide really unraveled the way that it did, that he killed his family. It just doesn't quite make sense. So a visit for the funeral turns into his own sort of rogue investigation. And this is mirrored by flashbacks to something that happened when they were all younger as well. And it's really incredibly well crafted. Veteran director Robert Connolly just turns the screws like a pro here. It keeps you absolutely on the edge of your seat with both of these stories, the flashback story and the present day murder investigation. And Eric Bana hasn't been this good in years. I mean, he really, really sinks his teeth into this part in just a perfect way. It's beautifully shot. The Australian landscape, it all takes place in an area just outside Melbourne during a drought, which is a wonderful metaphor for what's happening existentially to this community. It's incredibly well shot, well edited, just magnificently well crafted. And if you love whodunits, this is probably one of the best you're going to see in a long time.
The Dry Australian film is rated R, and it's available in select theaters, also on demand with Apple TV and Vudu. Milkwater, the drama stars Molly Bernard and Patrick Breen. The film's written and directed by Morgan Ingari. Peter, what'd you think of Milkwater?
This is a terrific little movie, very much under the radar. It's a first debut feature from Morgan Ingari, and it stars Molly Bernard, an actress I'm not really that familiar with. She's a star of TV Land series Younger. And she plays Milo, who's a 20-ish. She works in a guitar shop called String Theory. She's sort of disaffected. She has a gay female best friend, lawyer, who's had a baby shower at the beginning of the movie, and she feels very left out of all of that. So she goes to a bar, and she ends up befriending the owner of a gay bar, played by Patrick Breen, another wonderful performance. Who confides to her that he's been trying multiple times to have adoption or surrogate child, but none of this has worked out for him, and he's sort of disconsolate and feels like there's no future anymore in having a child of his own. And sort of impulsively, since they've become friends, she says, "Well, I'll be the surrogate. I'll be the egg donor." And it sort of comes out of nowhere, except that everyone's saying, "Do you really want to do this?" It's very impulsive, and he just seems to want to do something to change her life. And in the context of the movie, it makes sense. And then when she does, deliver the child, and it turns into something much deeper, because the connection between her and Roger is becomes a little tenuous. She becomes a little too, boundaryless, and he wants to sort of separate out a bit, what he is and the baby from her, and he has to separate, distance himself a bit, and it's very touching and poignant and very true to life in terms of who these characters really are. It reminded me a little bit of some of the movies of Ira Sachs, who's done, similar work with small scale people in New York, and it just really, I think it's a very well acted, very well written. The direction is on point. Really good with the performers. It's a very good debut.
Yeah, I was going to say impressive for Morgan Ngari making a feature directorial debut. The film, written and directed by Ngari, Milkwater stars Molly Bernard and Patrick Breen. It's unrated and it's available on demand. The platforms include Vudu and Fandango Now. Blast Beat, a film that takes us from Colombia to the United States, is directed by Esteban Arango, who's the co-screenwriter of the film, Mateo Arias, the star of the film. Angie, what'd you think of Blast Beat?
So Blast Beat is also a feature directorial debut by Esteban Arango. And I really like this one. I thought it was smart and sweet, a little bit messy, like it's maybe trying to explore too many different avenues at once. And it does follow some pretty predictable paths, but it's grounded in sincere emotion and very thoughtful about its exploration of the American dream and what it might mean to people coming in from outside the country and the challenges that they might face in pursuing it. So Mateo Arias plays Carly, the older brother who's a metalhead and math nerd who dreams of working for NASA someday. And Teo, the younger brother, is played by Moises Arias, who is a sort of wild card artist type who never wanted to leave Colombia to begin with. And because they're brothers in real life, which I think really adds to the chemistry, the bone deep understanding of that sibling relationship, that love hate, where the only thing that you want to do more than smack your brother for being an idiot is protect him from everyone else who might do that to him. And it's also, and because both brothers are into heavy metal, it's got a heavy metal soundtrack that does a really great job, I think, of capturing the turmoil and angst of being a teen, which goes double for these boys as they're dealing with family drama and immigration struggles. So not perfect, but really a solid, interesting film.
All right. The movie is Blast Beat, starring Mateo and Moises Arias, Esteban Arango, the director and co-screenwriter. It's unrated. It's in select theaters and available on demand on iTunes and Google Play. Into the Darkness, a Danish film directed by Anders Refn. The film is co-written by Anders Refn as well, and it stars Jesper Christensen. Wade, what'd you think of Into the Darkness?
Well, normally this is the kind of film that would be tailor-made for me. One of those wonderful, very precious World War II family sagas. In this case, it's a Danish family. The patriarch runs a factory, and it's the early days of German occupation. How are the Danes going to manage this? And of course, the family is of many different minds. The father wants to be more conciliatory, try to keep the factory open, but are we going to make things for the Nazis? One of his sons is very anti and gets in with the resistance, and there's a question: are you on the side of democracy, the side of Nazism, the side of communism? All of these things are in the mix, and it starts to feel, to a certain point, like an upper class Danish Fiddler on the Roof, this patriarch who can't quite keep his family together in the face of change, except set against a World War II backdrop. And normally, I love this kind of thing, and then it gets to the 2.5 the 2.5 hour mark, and it doesn't end. It stops. It literally has the most abrupt ending of any movie that I think I've ever seen. It just stops and the credits roll, and it's as though the 2.5 hours that you've invested in the movie to that point is a complete waste. And I found myself shocked that with all of the effort that went into this, they couldn't somehow come up with a satisfying way to bring the movie to a close.
Into the Darkness, Peter, did you experience the ending the same way?
Yeah, I checked, you know, I rewound. I wanted to
see something. What happened.
Yeah, no, I mean, it ends with the credits, a brief credit saying, you know, that the full resistance movement in Denmark didn't really start till 1943, year after the movie ends, you know, end of story. It almost seems, but apparently this is not the case, that it was some kind of mini series that they just lopped off the ending to. You know, it reminds me of my old newspaper days when you have these editors, you know, your piece is too long, so they just cut three graphs at the bottom of the piece. It's completely inexplicable, especially since, you know, as Wade said, it's a 2.5-hour movie. It's not like they didn't have time to figure out, you know, how to create a rounded narrative. In general, I mean, it's a fairly good conventional family drama, you know, with this the central conflict is really, you know, what's the difference between collusion and survival in a situation like this? You know, there's a non-aggression pact with the Nazis, but basically, you know, you have to choose sides. And Jesper Christensen, who plays the patriarch, is a wonderful actor. People may recognize him from some Jan Troell movies, especially Everlasting Moments. And his wife, played by Bodil Jorgensen, is also quite good. But, you know, the three children have a very different one, you know, is essentially pro-Nazi, and the other is very, you know, radical partisan left. And then the daughter falls in love with a German U-boat officer who looks so Aryan that he makes Rutger Hauer look like Charles Laughton. You know, so, I mean, there's a great range of narrative in this movie. But, you know, as we've said, the ending is completely lopped off to the point where I don't know that there's anyone who isn't confused by it. It just, I don't know what they were thinking.
Into the Darkness, a Danish drama directed by Anders Refn, who co-wrote the screenplay. The film is unrated. Coming up with our critics, we'll hear what Angie thinks of New Order, a film that's set in Mexico City. And we have a film that was originally released in 1981, The New Deal for Artists, which takes a look at the WPA and government-supported arts programs. Orson Welles narrating the film, which has been remastered. That's to come on Film Week.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Peter Rayner, Wade Major, and Angie Hahn. Next up is New Order, a film set in Mexico City. It's written and directed by Michelle Franco. Angie, what'd you think of New Order?
What a disappointment. It's like it wants to be Parasite with that kind of biting commentary about classism, but it ends up a little too enamored of its own chaos and cynicism to reach a coherent message. And the reason it's so disappointing is because it starts out really promising with this montage of really striking images that we won't understand till later, but capture our attention right away. You see like dead bodies and destruction and green paint running through the streets. And you're like, I want to know what's going on. And then it kind of jumps back to show you what led up to this. And it begins in this upper class wedding in Mexico City that's interrupted by a violent uprising of the city's underclass, and the bride is taken hostage. And the first act is really good. Franco does such a great job of conveying how grotesque it is that these one percenters remain in this bubble, treating the protest as nothing more than an irritation until it's way too late. You get a great sense of what this community is like and who these people are and how their world works, and how that false sense of security is entirely propped up by the labor of their much less well-off staff. They're not all bad people necessarily. It's just that they're kind of callous in the way of people who can afford to be. But then after the bride is kidnapped, it starts to go off the rails. The movie zooms out, so it's not just about these people, but what happens to the whole country. And I think when that happens, it starts to really lose sight of the personality and nuance that made the first act so compelling. One of its biggest weaknesses is that despite how much of it hinges on these protests, you don't actually get a great sense of who the people are that are leading this protest, like what they want exactly, like of the grievances that brought them there. It doesn't really care that much about their perspective, which is kind of a strange way of, I think, of telling the story. And then it just gets more and more brutal, and it ends up spiraling into nihilism and brutality. It seems like for nihilism and brutality's own sake. I give the director credit for not holding back, but after a while, it just seems like he's interested in pushing buttons just because he can. There's definitely something he's trying to get at here with his warning of what could happen if class divisions are just left to worsen, but it feels like such a shallow provocation.
We're talking about the film set in Mexico City, New Order, from writer-director Michel Franco. The film's rated R. It's in select theaters. The documentary The New Deal for Artists has now been remastered and is getting a new release. The documentary originally out in 1981. It's written and directed by Weiland Schultz-Kiel. Peter, what did you think of The New Deal for Artists?
It's really interesting. It's narrated by Orson Welles, who also was featured in the film as one of the recipients of the Works Progress Administration ministrations. It was a public arts program that was for all kinds of artists, you know, painters, writers, photographers, many others, that was in effect for, you know, throughout much of the Depression, and gave work to an extraordinary range of artists who in many cases first started out working on projects at the time, including painters like Jackson Pollock, Ashiel Gorky, Frank Stella, the writers, Ralph Ellison, Saul Bellow worked on some of the state guidebooks. Richard Wright's Native Son was basically bolstered by the project. The director Joe Losey, who worked with John Houseman and Welles and others in a lot of theater projects. There's some clips of Welles' production, all-black production of Macbeth. It's a fascinating deep dive into that era. Also, the Farm Security Administration, which was an offshoot of this, produced some of the greatest photography that we've ever seen in this country by, famous photos by Dorothea Lange, Walker Evans, and others. It was really an opportunity for American artists to sort of look to their own country for inspiration and subject matter, as opposed to Paris, in the case of painters especially. It all came to a crashing halt when the Congressman Martin Dees and the House Un-American Activities Committee really put a great deal of pressure on Roosevelt, et cetera, to muffle this because of supposed communist influence. But Studs Terkel is interviewed in it, John Houseman, Nelson Algren, Norman Lloyd.
I was going to say Norman Lloyd, who we're going to talk about later.
I mean, it's amazing that he, covered such a historical span. But it's really fascinating. And I suppose there's a certain connection to where we are now. There's talk of some sort of equivalent federal arts project. That might occur in California and perhaps countrywide. So it's really a fascinating look at these people, all of whom are really gone now who were interviewed, plus many others that we see, in terms of the work that they did, the murals that they did, and it's fascinating.
I'll bet. The New Deal for Artists, a documentary now remastered. It's released in select virtual cinemas. Lemley's Virtual Cinema will have it the middle of next month, but some of the others have it right now. The documentary is unrated. The drama When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit is directed by Caroline Link, who co-wrote the screenplay. It's based on Judith Kerr's novel. Wade, what did you think of When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit?
Again, another one of these very precious World War II family sagas, but this one is much more to my speed and my liking, based on, and Judith Kerr's book is actually a memoir very much of her own experiences, and that's what this is based on. This is directed by Caroline Link, the amazing German director who won an Oscar for her 2001 film Nowhere in Africa. And this is a little bit the same DNA. Nowhere in Africa was about a German Jewish refugee family in Africa. This is about a German Jewish refugee family whose father is a very controversial journalist. He's been writing a lot opposing the rise of the Nazis. And on the eve of Hitler's ascent to power, he's warned that that Hitler has it in for him. So he has to leave. He eventually brings his family with him and they flee Germany. They go to Switzerland. They go to France. And it is very much seen through the eyes of his two children, his daughter and his son, and how they evaluate their sense of identity, their sense of Germanness, of Jewishness, their humanity, just in the face of what they are now being forced to do in abandoning the country and the culture in which they were born. It doesn't go to any great dramatic heights. It doesn't sort of, really pull a lot of the emotions that some of these films usually do, but it's so beautifully made, and Caroline Link is just such an exquisite director. The score is wonderful. The kid actors are really, really just pitch perfect. So I really enjoyed the 2 hours that I sat watching this.
We're talking about When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit, Peter.
I was a little less enthusiastic because I think, I don't know, the family flees Berlin in 1933, first to Switzerland and then to France. And the father is a well-known theater critic who's critical of Hitler, so there's always sort of a target on his back. But overall, it didn't seem as if there was enough real danger happening in this movie, given what it's really about. It's seen through the eyes of this 9-year-old girl, Anna. But it also seems to be filmed in a way that doesn't really expand on the fact that, you know, what the little girl sees and what's going on around her is really quite different. And you don't see a tremendous amount of violence or really, you know, vitriolic, scathing anti-Semitism. It just, you know, the family is pretty middle class, and so there are, you know, the girl visits the Eiffel Tower, and they're upset that the children will have to attend public versus private schools, and the little boy doesn't have, you know, the money to go to a movie. It just, I don't know, it all just seemed like there wasn't enough gravity in this narrative to hook it to some larger subject, which clearly it is.
When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit is unrated. Caroline Link, the director. It's at several of the Lemley theaters as well as Lemley's virtual cinema. The Romanian comedy Two Lottery Tickets is written and directed by Paul Negrescu, based on a short story. Angie, what'd you think of Two Lottery Tickets?
This one's fun. It's about a trio of these down-on-their-luck friends who correctly guess the winning numbers for the lottery, which would be great news, except that they realize immediately that they have lost their tickets. So then the movie follows them as they spend the rest of the time trying to track down the tickets. So first they go door-to-door through an apartment building looking for clues, then they end up going on a little road trip to try to track down the person that they think has stolen it from them. So the whole movie is just like this three clueless dudes bickering while trying to look for clues and figure out what happened. And it feels almost like a series of vignettes with these guys encountering all sorts of people on their journey. They meet like a fortune teller who takes advantage of their desperation. They meet a bunch of weed dealers who are maybe even more oblivious and clueless than they are. And in what I think is just the funniest scene, it made me laugh so much, one really exasperated police officer. And most of these characters don't stick around long enough to become major characters, but I loved how tiny and specific each slice of life feels. It also helps that the three guys have really distinct personalities, but also this lived-in chemistry of longtime friends who drive each other nuts almost as much as they actually like each other. And I think that's what works so well about the movie. It's not that it doesn't feel like a movie, but every set and every character feels like we're just dropping in on a world that already exists. I had a really good time. At one point in the movie, one of the characters complains about how Romanian films are all doom and gloom these days, and this is definitely not that. It's just this shaggy little road trip movie where the fun is just in watching it unfold.
Two Lottery Tickets, Romanian comedy, written and directed by Paul Noguesco. The film's unrated, and you can see it at Lemley's Virtual Cinema. Final Account documentary about the last living generation of Hitler's Third Reich, the film directed by Luke Holland. Wade?
Really an absolutely superb. It's World War II Day today. Really a superb documentary. You know, normally we get films that recount the testimony of people who are Holocaust survivors or perhaps have been political figures who you rarely sort of see the testimony from those who were simply German at the time and who have a rather fascinating perspective. And as I've told on this show many times, you know, my mother was a World War II German refugee. So I grew up in this environment. I grew up with my mother and her siblings having these exact conversations and seeing the war and experiencing the war from this perspective. So this really took me back to that. And it is an amazing collection of voices that oftentimes contradict each other. Some said, well, of course we knew what was happening. And others say, oh, well, no one had any idea what was happening. And there's even one guy at one point who sort of parrots the German nationalist position and comes so dangerously close to saying, you know, Hitler was right, that a chill just goes down your spine. It's an amazingly rich tapestry of memory and forgetfulness and history. And it fills a vital void, I think, in the catalog of these films. So it's really essential to see if you want to sort of round out your historical knowledge. Final Account, excellent film.
Final Account is directed by Luke Holland. It's at multiple Lemley theaters, at the Century Stadium 25 in the City of Orange, and other select theaters. It's rated PG-13. The Last Days, an Oscar-winning documentary from 1998 that was executive produced by Steven Spielberg, directed by James Maul. The film has been remastered and is getting a re-release on Netflix. Wade, please tell us about The Last Days.
Yeah, here we go, rounding out the subject for the day. The Last Days won an Academy Award, Best Documentary, and rightfully so. Basically, looks at it's part of the Shoah project, and it looks specifically at the experiences of five Hungarian Jews who survived Auschwitz. And it's been beautifully remastered, still very, very much one of the most powerful Oscar-nominated and Oscar-winning documentaries of the last quarter century or so. And it is really still a superb film. Looks beautiful in the remastering, and along with Final Account and anything else that people want to dig up to sort of make sure that their understanding of this history is thorough and complete. You just can't do better. The Last Days is an essential entry in that field.
The Last Days is rated PG-13. The documentary is now streaming on Netflix. Let's at least get started with the French romantic drama Spring Blossom. The film is written, directed by, and stars Suzanne Lindon. Angie, please tell us about Spring Blossom.
One of the notable things about this movie is that Lindon directed the film when she was 19 and wrote the screenplay when she was just 15. So as such, it's a film that is really grounded in the character's perspective and much less so in this older man's perspective. There's only a few short scenes from his perspective with her absent, and even less so in what the outside world thinks of this relationship, which is automatically going to make it a little bit queasy or controversial for some people. But I appreciated how seriously it takes her experience and her feelings and her agency without judgment or hand-wringing. We're definitely aware of the age difference, but it's all about how she feels and not how everyone else feels. And it is also worth noting that the relationship between them never gets overtly physical. And it's a film that I think is really effective at getting at feelings that maybe at the time you're experiencing them, you don't quite feel you can put them into words.
Hold off at that point. We'll come right back to you and hear more about the French romantic drama Spring Blossom, starring Suzanne Lindon, who wrote and directed the film at age 19 as well. You're listening to Film Week on KPCC. Back in just 1 minute. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Wade Major, Angie Hahn, and Peter Rayner. We're talking about the French romantic drama Spring Blossom that was written by Suzanne Lindon when she was 15 years old. She's now directing her screenplay at the age of 19 and stars in the film. Angie is telling us about Spring Blossom. Please continue.
Yeah, one of the most interesting stylistic choices she makes is that she hits the biggest emotional beats of the relationship not through dialogue, but through dance pieces that border on surreal. Like at one point, Suzanne is dancing through the streets after they've set their first date, or you watch a scene of them swaying in sync to opera music to signal how much they have in common, or how much she thinks that they have in common, at least. Or her coming to this epiphany while she's slow dancing with him at a party. And I think that considering that this is a movie that's really hard to tackle and really hard, and I think that when you kind of try to say it out loud, it sounds really thorny. It's a really interesting choice to try to get at these bigger feelings.
Spring Blossom, wait, what do you think?
Agree completely. This is a wonderful film. And those little surrealistic accents are really, really brave. And I wonder sometimes, you know, if an older filmmaker might not have been a little more cynical and second-guessed that choice, and that there's an idealism, a youthful idealism in her, where she just goes for broke and she does it because it feels right. Because the rest of the film is so naturalistic. And what the French do better than anyone else is represent the naturalistic rhythms and feelings of French life. There's just no other national cinema that does that. It's the soil they're planted in. And it just feels so authentic, and the lives feel so lived in. And it's a very, very impressive effort. Suzanne Lyndon, by the way, is you know, she's French cinema royalty. Her father is Vincent Lyndon, and her mother is Sandrine Kiberlin, who played together in Mademoiselle Chambon about a decade or so ago. So, you know, she grew up in the business. Her parents are both very distinguished actors. And she understands something about how to sort of merge the tools of cinema with the authenticity of expressing French life and emotion. And she does it beautifully. She's a great talent to watch.
Spring Blossom is unrated. It's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema, and Lemley's showing it on screen at their Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Tomorrow's Hope, a documentary focused on education. Thomas Morgan, the director. Peter.
This is a movie that was partially produced by the Saul Zantz Charitable Foundation. The mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, speaks as the film opens. So it's very much a kind of, you know, authorized and endorsed, not infomercial exactly, but you know, something that's I think less of an incisive, you know, a deep dive documentary than sort of a promotional vehicle for a very worthy project. It follows three present day high school seniors who, from preschool on, were part of this experimental EduCare program. That's now spread, you know, across the country, including, I think, some areas of California.
Long Beach has an EduCare program.
Yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating. In the case of the school in question, it started out, it was originally located in the largest housing project in the country and also one of the poorest. It was nicknamed, you know, Forgottonia. And you see what an effect this kind of education, you know, really close contact, caring, you know, the teachers are really involved, the students are uplifted in how it affects their lives, and the three that they focus on, you know, all seem to be going in the right direction. Jalen, Crystal, and Jamal. You know, one is psychology, wants to go to psychology, pre-med, you know, a drummer. So it's fascinating to see that, but there isn't enough of who they are, you know, throughout their lives. And there was footage of them early on as little, you know, little kids. So I wish I had seen a little bit more focus on them from a very personal angle, as opposed to the sort of more broad brush, you know, promotional aspect of the film. But it's gratifying to know that such a program exists, and in that reason, I think it's worthwhile to see.
We're talking about the documentary from director Thomas Morgan, Tomorrow's Hope. It's unrated and on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. We have a couple minutes here for our last two films. The Penny Black is a documentary directed by William J. Saunders. Wade?
So even though this also has a problem with the ending in that it sort of teases you and then sends you to their website to try to find out how the story ends. I still found it a very, very compelling film. It's effectively a kind of a noir documentary where the documentary crew found this guy who is the son of a con man, and he claims to be in possession of this multi-million dollar stamp collection given to him by a sketchy Russian neighbor who has now disappeared. And that launches into this remarkably weird journey through the kind of underbelly of Los Angeles, where you're never quite sure who's lying and who's not lying and why things are happening. And even though it never really pays off all of the intrigue that it sets up, it's actually still kind of a fun ride. And the guy at the center of it, this son of a con man who may or may not be a con man himself, is so emotionally unreliable that you do constantly question yourself, and you question him, and you even question the filmmakers at a certain point, who kind of try to go rogue to see if they can't get back behind the story. It's quite an interesting journey. It doesn't really go anywhere in particular, but it's a fun ride while you're on it.
We're talking about The Penny Black, Peter.
I agree with Wade. I mean, it's very noirish, and the fact that the central character of this guy is the sort of documentary equivalent of an unreliable narrator in fiction, you know, you really don't know throughout the movie if he himself is a con artist. It's a very weird story, and it gets weirder as it goes along. I think the filmmaker originally had met this guy just socially and was told about the stamp collection and thought this would make a great movie. And so for several years, he followed him along and sort of went down this rabbit hole of you know, noirish stuff. But yeah, I mean, the ending, this is the second movie this week that just kind of ends. And except in this case, there's something about, you know, if you log on to a website, you can find out more about what happened after they shot the movie. And, you know, it's like enough already. But this is one of these truth is stranger than fiction things. Yeah. Otherwise, I would say it would make a great, you know, Chandler-esque fiction movie, too.
The Penny Black, the documentary, William J. Saunders, the director. It's unrated on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. And finally, Angie, can you tell us briefly about Simon Barrett, the writer and director's new horror film, Seance?
Yes, so this is Barrett's feature directing debut after he wrote a lot of other movies, including The Guest and You're Next. And this is not great, but I had a good time. It starts out really clunky. The characters are kind of boring and broadly drawn, and it, you know, it seems to tip its hand a little bit too early. But credit where it's due, as it goes on, the crazy sort of slowly ramps up until by the end, it's just piling plot twists on top of plot twists and bloody death on top of bloody death. And it is just this big, precarious mess of a plot. And I was kind of laughing and having fun. Like, I don't want to spoil too much, but it just goes completely off the rails. It's really silly, but I think that's its saving grace. It's not trying to pretend to be anything deeper than it is. It's not putting on airs of being, you know, quote unquote, elevated horror. It's not asking for deep emotional investment. It's just like, hey, do you want to watch a bunch of kids die and wonder what the hell is going on? Pop open a bottle of wine, take a seat. The ultimate answers are not necessarily going to be satisfying, but they are going to be kind of strange.
Seance is the horror film from writer-director Simon Barrett, making his feature directorial debut. The film is rated R. It's in select theaters and also available to be seen at home on Fandango Now, Vudu, iTunes, and Google Play. Coming up on Film Week, we're going to remember three Hollywood figures of film and television who we lost in the past week and a half or so. They include the oldest living working actor Norman Lloyd, who died 106 years of age. Lloyd was an extraordinary figure, not just as an actor, going back to Mercury Theater and through all of his television and film roles. He was also a producer of television series with Alfred Hitchcock. We'll talk about Paul Mooney, such an influential comedian, writer, and actor himself. And we, of course, remember Charles Grodin, who we lost just a few days ago. That and some picks from our Film Week critics, their favorite films so far this year, that to come.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiots and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Film Week on KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Peter Rayner, Angie Hahn, and Wade Major. In just a little bit, we're going to get our critics' picks for some of their favorites of the first four-plus months of the year. But we want to take this opportunity to remember the passing of some prodigious talents in Hollywood. We begin with Charles Grodin, tremendous actor, comedian, late-night talk show guest, who died earlier this week at the age of 86. Peter, please start us off on some of your favorites of Charles Grodin. One of the ones I love so much, a fairly small role, but in Heaven Can Wait with Warren Beatty, Diane Cannon, just a very funny performance.
Yeah, I mean, he was a remarkable team player for someone who, you know, was so singular in his acting and his persona. He worked remarkably well with a great range of actors, you know, in Midnight Run with De Niro. And my favorite of his movies was his big breakthrough film as a film actor, Heartbreak Kid, directed by Elaine May. He's just absolutely amazing in that movie. And the scene with him, you know, telling Silver Shepherd's father, Eddie Albert, you know, why he loves his daughter. There's just so many great moments in that. And a neglected movie, The Lonely Guy, that he played with Steve Martin. You know, there's a scene with him on a park bench where Grodin is musing about why it is that homeless men all seem to have very full heads of hair. He was really a tremendously versatile, given the fact that you know we thought we knew who he was in the movies, but he was with a new generation of moviegoers in films like Beethoven and, you know, Muppets and so forth. He created a new loyalty of fan base, but he was also tremendous on talk shows with Carson and many others. Just a wonderful actor.
Terrific talent. And Wade, I understand you watched in rapid succession Grodin's appearances on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Oh, they sparred in the most joyous way imaginable. And it was, of course, planned and prepared to some degree, but the way he would get Carson off his game, he kept a straight face, and, you know, Johnny would dish it back. It's as good as late night talk shows have ever been with his appearances on The Tonight Show, and it's all on YouTube. You can watch it. It's some of the funniest stuff you will ever see. When I was in college, we were shown his screen test for The Graduate as well. And clearly he was not right for the Hoffman part, but he was right for so many other parts. And it is such a funny screen test. It's one of those things where you watch it and you think, we're not going to hire this guy for this movie, but we will hire him for a whole bunch of other movies. And that's what happened.
Wade, let's continue by remembering Paul Mooney, a writer, a performer, worked on as the head writer on In Living Color, the TV series. He helped create the character Homie the Clown. He was on Chappelle's Show and also worked with Richard Pryor. We lost Paul Mooney at the age of 79.
Yeah, and he also wrote for, he was basically Richard Pryor's writing alter ego. He wrote some of Pryor's best material. He was head writer for the Richard Pryor Show. He also wrote for Sanford and Son and Good Times. You know, he is an epic comedy figure in American culture. There are only two great comedy traditions that really kind of emerged and burst forth from the 60s, and that's the Jewish Catskillian tradition and black comedy. And Paul Mooney spans the entire history of black comedy in America from the 60s to the present day. I mean, like we said, you know, Chappelle's Show and the Richard Pryor Show and Sanford and Son. This is amazing. And on top of that, he wasn't just a great writer. He was an amazing performer. He pushed buttons on stage. He was Lenny Bruce level, intense, provocateur. He brought it and he pushed to the edge and he made people laugh and cringe at the same time and walk out really thoughtful about the things that he had talked about. I mean, he's a giant figure in American comedy, and I hope the coming years really do him justice.
And we will remember Norman Lloyd, who we lost at the age of 106 at the time of his death, our longest living actor who worked well into his 90s. Peter, a remarkable career. And when he was blacklisted, Alfred Hitchcock hired him as a producer of his popular television series. And yet another creative manifestation of Lloyd, who directed stage productions, starred in Hitchcock's Saboteur, and was one of the ensemble members of the terrific TV series St. Elsewhere in the 80s. What a career.
Yeah, it's an amazing career, you know, stretching from the 30s until fairly recently. He worked with many of the great directors. Jean Renoir's best Hollywood movie, The Southerner, he's featured in that. He's in a terrific World War II movie called Walk in the Sun, Chaplin, Limelight. You know, he was a tennis partner of Chaplin's in real life. He was very active in the La Jolla Playhouse. As you mentioned, the Alfred Hitchcock Presents, some of the best episodes he was directly involved with, as well as earlier on in the Federal Theater Project, the group theater. You know, he really covered the waterfront. One project I wish I could see is he directed a series of shows for the Omnibus TV series on Lincoln, written by James Agee. And that must be extraordinary. I met him several times, and he was such a courtly, funny guy. I mean, he grew up, he was, Norman Perlmutter from Brooklyn, but he had this sort of courtly, almost yes. British, you know, you would never know. But at the age of 98, I felt he could definitely take me in tennis, no bar, but even so, I mean, he was just a remarkable walking history of American show business.
Well, let's take a couple minutes here to get a pick or two from each of our critics' favorite films so far. Angie, I know these were, of course, under Oscar consideration, Minari, Judas and the Black Messiah. But a film that you really want to tout, or animated film on Netflix, The Mitchells versus the Machines. Briefly, what's that about?
It's about a family who have to deal with the robot apocalypse. And I think it's this year's Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, as far as I'm concerned. I was really touched by the story, which involves this father and daughter who are trying to bond while trying to save all of humanity. But I was really taken by the visual style, which has this almost hand-painted flair, but also really borrows from the visual language of the internet. I will say, if it looks kind of bad on your laptop, try a bigger screen. It made a world of difference when I watched it on my much nicer TV. But yeah, it's just so gleeful. It feels so fresh and funny, and I just had such a great time with it.
The Mitchells versus the Machines is rated PG, and it's on Netflix. Peter, for you, why don't you tell us about the documentary Gunda, which is one of your picks.
Yeah, it's a terrific movie is about farm animals, mostly shot in Norway and several other countries. It focuses on a mother pig and her piglets, it's incredibly moving because you actually see without blinders the dailiness of the lives of these animals and how they work and how the mother deals with the pigs, piglets, and it's beautifully shot in black and white, no narration, no nothing. You just are there to watch this unfold before your eyes, and it's incredibly sad at the end too, in terms of what happens. You know,
so we'll be prepared. Viktor Kosakowski is the director of Gunda, which is available on Apple TV, and Wade has some picks, including Netflix's The Dig, starring Ralph Fiennes and Carey Mulligan, directed by Simon Stone, also recommending Our Friend, available on demand, starring Casey Affleck, Dakota Johnson, and Jason Segel. For our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us at Film Week.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.